Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. Everyone needs water to survive, but managing water and access to water resources can be complicated tasks for tribes. In the next hour, we'll learn more about water settlements across Native America, and we want to hear from you. Do you have enough water for yourself and your family or for your livestock? Are you dealing with laws and regulations that make it difficult for you to get enough water? All voices are welcome as we open up our electronic talking circle to water management right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus. A bipartisan group of lawmakers are trying to renew the Indian Coal Production Tax Credit, which is expected to create jobs in parts of Indian country. Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
In 2003, the tax credit offered Montana's Crow tribe $2 for every one ton of coal produced from a coal facility. The credit was one of several tax breaks that expired at the end of last year during the fiscal cliff crisis. Montana Democratic Senator John Walsh says the tax credit will revive the Crow Reservation after nearly 6 months without the economic aid.
Political brinksmanship has won out at the expense of good-paying jobs and certainty for millions of American businesses and taxpayers. This particular provision not only helps tribes responsibly develop their natural resources, but it also creates and sustains jobs and economic development in Indian country to support self-sufficiency and self-determination.
Unemployment on the Crow Reservation was roughly 25% in 2012. Walsh says the renewal of the tax credit is desperately needed for Montana's Crow tribe. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The Obama administration announced new initiatives today to address the impacts of climate change across the country, including in Native communities. Funding and support will go to serve state, local, and tribal programs. Last month, President Obama announced a competition to encourage the development of new models for addressing recovery and risk analysis for natural disasters. Nearly $1 billion is dedicated to the National Disaster Resilience Competition. Other programs announced today include a guide that tribes and local governments can use to assess health concerns related to climate change. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs announced the new Federal Tribal Climate Resilience Partnership and Technical Assistance Program. A school district in the Pacific Northwest has received funding to support Native students. Giselle Halfmoon has details on how the new grant will be used.
The Pendleton School District, in collaboration with the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, has received more than $100,000 in grants from the Oregon Department of Education. Assistant Superintendent Tricia Mooney states the American Indian, Alaskan Native Culturally Teaching, Learning, and Pedagogy grant funds were awarded to improve the classroom performances for local Native American students.
Our grant is titled Fostering Cultural Competence Through Collaborative Partnership. We will be focused on developing curriculum that is unique to our local tribes and tribal history and cultural responsive activities that we'll be able to use with not only students but also with staff.
In addition to culturally enhancing student curriculum and teacher proficiency, the grant provides a more developed transition for students interested in furthering their development into higher education.
We also will develop some dual credit classes through the knowledge base of, you know, tribal staff and tribal members to offer to our high school students so they could receive some dual credit courses. We're partnering with BMCC on that.
Reporting in Pendleton, Oregon, I'm Giselle Halfmoon.
Tribal conservation officers from 14 tribes recently attended a law enforcement training in Montana. Tribal law enforcement officers, including wildlife officers, must meet certain annual training requirements set by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The training covered skills such as crime scene investigation, wildlife field forensics, and the use of force. Attendees also learned about signs of drug activity and federal laws in Indian country. The tribal officer training was led by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service with support from the Department of Interior and Department of Justice. Instructors also came from the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, and the U.S. Attorney's Office. The Crow Tribe hosted the training and worked with the Native American Fish and Wildlife Society. For National Native News, I'm Sarah Gustavus.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. Water is a crucial resource. We all need it to survive, and water is also sacred for many Native communities. But water rights and access to water can be complicated. In recent decades, many tribes have approved settlements with the federal and state officials on water rights, and other cases are pending now. In the next hour, we'll learn more about water settlements and who decides how much water a tribe can access from a river or another water resource. And you're welcome to join our conversation today. Do you have enough water in your community? And what would it mean if the river in your area stopped flowing? Our number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we're going to start the conversation today with Rebecca Miles. And Rebecca is the executive director of the Nez Perce Tribe, and she's the former chair of the Tribal Council. Rebecca is a member of the Nez Perce Tribe. Welcome to Native America Calling, Rebecca.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Rebecca, you were first elected to your Tribal Council in 2004, and then a water settlement that impacted the tribe was announced shortly after. And the council had to decide whether to approve that settlement. Why was the settlement significant for you and members of your tribe?
Yes, in May of 2004, I was elected, and literally 7 days later, three sovereigns, including the Nez Perce Tribe, the United States, and the state of Idaho, made public terms that had been negotiated for almost a decade, released those terms publicly on what they potentially would agree on. And all three sovereigns would have 9 months to decide if they were going to accept the terms and enter into this agreement. This magnitude of an agreement for the Nez Perce Tribe was by far the largest agreement since treaty time. So definitely huge agreement, a lot to consider, a lot of years of work were put into getting to that point. And so you can already start to see the challenge, because water is the most sacred thing to Indian people. And so, you know, this was something that, you know, the Nez Perce had to weigh heavily and consider.
And Rebecca, how long did negotiations go on behind closed doors on that agreement before it was announced?
I believe officially, confidentiality was set in place in 1998, I want to say, and your other guest on the phone may have the exact time. The actual adjudication of water started in the mid-80s, maybe 85 or 86, 1985 or 86, and that was in the Upper Snake on a stream called Swan Falls. And of course, the Nez Perce were not involved at that time. What the judge said in those jurisdiction was, I want to settle the entire Snake River Basin. And so the Nez Perce were pulled into the adjudication, really, because that would be the only time you could claim water or you would lose your rights forever. And so it kind of set off this kind of firestorm of everybody claiming water for their specific need, including the Nez Perce tribe. So, you could see it had gone on for, at the time, 17, 18 years, but the private negotiations were probably not, probably less than 10, maybe 7 years or so.
All right. And again, our phone lines are open. We want to hear from you today, Native America. Have there been challenges to your tribe's water rights? What is your tribe doing? What kind of other conversations go along with tribes asserting their authority over water they're connected to? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And Rebecca, there were a lot of emotions after the agreement was announced, before the council voted on it, voted to approve it. What did you hear from members of your tribe in meetings during those 9 months?
It was very difficult, and literally, I was the rookie a week into it. I think the announcement was, "Do you want to fly down with the chairman and for this, you know, announcement?" And I had no idea what I was getting into. Of course, the terms were made public, and then the parties could talk about it with their separate sovereigns. We came back and had a public meeting, our very first public meeting. And unfortunately, what we did was we had our attorneys, do the public meeting with our people. And that was really a mistake right out of the chute. You know, here you are settling something so sacred to Indian people, and you have attorneys, you know, and it was no fault to our attorneys. It was a bloodbath meeting, the very first meeting. It was an insult. A lot of people were insulted. People were angry that we would even do, you know, such a meeting in such a way. And so that's really how I got involved, is I started meeting, and the very next day I walked into our Office of Legal Counsel and said, you know, teach me this settlement. We've got to present this, and our tribal council is the one that needs to be out there explaining, you know, why we're here, you know, what are the terms in the settlement. And, you know, that set off a series of about 18 or 19 hearings, which were, you know, it was really difficult because, you know, it was a lot of uncertainty at the time. We had some changes in our tribal council as well. So the very, you know, we were going to make this decision right before our next tribal council election, and 5 seats were up. So that was a majority of vote. And so it was just a really, you look at the odds we were up against, and initially my thought was this would never pass on my watch. You know, I just thought it was never going to be approved. And then what happened was we had a series of meetings, and we would go, I would lead them, and I was a rookie, so it was very hard for our tribal people to understand, you know, that I was actually credible to be able to say a lot of these things. But I was learning just as the tribal people were. I was learning as the public was learning. And so we would take questions and then go back as a team and answer, look at all the answers, and then we'd go back to the next hearing and provide those answers, and we'd just keep
building. And Rebecca, I can totally understand, you know, how this can quickly get complicated, especially when we're talking about asserting water rights with connections, you know, to legislation or either laws that, you know, date back. And we know that tribes have a long history of asserting their water rights, or, you know, also connecting with the right people so that they do know what they are. And I do appreciate you sharing with us. And of course, if we have any listeners in the audience, maybe you're tuned in on KIYE. Do you also remember when this settlement was announced? What did you think? 1-800-996-2848. And, you know, when it comes to our own tribal communities, do you think more of us need to learn more about our water rights when it comes to, you know, some of these settlements? You know, have you ever been to a public meeting in your tribal community and you didn't see any tribal members explaining what was going on with the water rights? Did it raise suspicion? You know, what did you think? Or maybe it prompted you to be, much like we heard our guest Rebecca say, she wanted to learn more about this. We want to hear from you today, Native America. Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. And Rebecca, I know our communities, you know, we're very connected, and in our communities, there's a lot of family members. Anything you want to share about, you know, how on a personal level, this settlement also connected to your own family? You know, what did you hear from them as this settlement was on the table?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember my mom came to the very first meeting, my mother, and she was angry. I remember seeing her just so angry. And I've never, you know, she's not someone who's involved in the politics. She doesn't come to elections or anything. And so, you know, that struck a chord with me. And then I remember, you know, even to this day, I mean, it's been years now since we've approved the settlement. I still, you know, in a public meeting, get accused of selling the water rights of the Nez Perce tribe or selling individual water rights. And you know, after going through this extensive process of learning, you know, all the facts about the settlement, the terms, what would the future if we didn't accept the settlement, all of those things, I'm very confident in the decision, more than confident. And so I know time will, you know, eventually speak, history will speak for itself, and, you know, years down the road we'll look back, you know, because the horizon of water settlements is very, you know, and John Echohawk could speak to this more. I know your other guest is, you know, the future of water settlements is very scary because every stream and river in the country is over-appropriated. It doesn't matter if you're in the desert area or if you're in a healthy area where we are, where there's a lot of water, they're all over-appropriated. And so future water rights, ensuring you have water for your specific needs is a very scary subject
and Rebecca, I also want to throw that out to our listening audience. You know, are you weary of the future of water rights when it comes to our tribal communities? Call us right now. We want to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848. Also, here is another question. You know, is water sacred to your own tribe? And do you still have access to the waters that sustained your ancestors? Call in. Tell us what waters are in danger in your area and what kind of concerns do you have when it comes to water rights. Call us right now, 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Judy in Kamiai, Idaho, tuned in on KIYE. Judy, welcome to the hour, and what would you like to share?
Hi, welcome. Thank you. I just wanted to share that I've been pretty involved with my, you know, with what happens with my tribe for decades. You know, I've got six children, a large family. We're fishermen, and, you know, we use these waters. And I was involved in the Snake River Basin adjudication process, attended meetings, kept notes, got inches thick files on it. And I just wanted to say that, you know, the people, we were against the Snake River Basin adjudication agreement. And many people in the Nez Perce, we call it, you know, a steel treaty. A form of a steel treaty. And we went to our government. We told them no. But they didn't listen. The attorneys adamantly did not listen. I've got the old notes, and I've got elders who spoke against this. We did not want that agreement. But what I'm concerned with now is how the tribe itself regulates the membership. We got members, tribal members, who owe thousands of dollars in water bills. They've actually had their water shut off by our own tribe. Yet there's money for infrastructure in the millions. That money's been misappropriated as we speak. So I, as a Nez Perce, I'm opposed to the Snake River Basin adjudication. Many of our ancestors rolled in their graves when this happened. So anybody who feels that they can get up there and grandstand, they're mistaken. And someday they will look back on that and have tears.
All right. Thank you for your call, Judy, there in Kamiai, Idaho. And Rebecca, I also want to give you a moment to respond to our caller. Again, you can also join the conversation, 1-800-99-NATIVE. Go ahead, Rebecca. Anything you'd like to add about, you know, concerns that still exist today? Go ahead.
One thing I absolutely agree with Judy on is the tribe didn't want to even be in the situation. As I had mentioned in the mid-80s, when they were adjudicating the Upper Snake, we weren't involved. The judge at that time, I think it's important for your listeners across the country as well to know, because it is a bit of a shock when tribes have to find out they have to adjudicate water in state court. So this state court judge basically made a ruling that he wanted to adjudicate the entire Snake River Basin, and that is how the Nez Perce were involved. States have the power to adjudicate water claims, and the Nez Perce had to make their water claims or they would forever be lost. So that is something I agree totally. We didn't want to be in this situation, and I don't think any tribe really wants to be in that situation of having to settle their claims with a state jurisdiction.
All right, thanks, Rebecca. Let's go ahead and bring in another guest who has also been dealing with water settlements. I've been dealing with them for many years. We have John Echohawk on the line, and John is the executive director of the Native American Rights Fund, and he is a member of the Pawnee Nation. Welcome back to Native America Calling, John.
Noah, that's our traditional greeting in our Pawnee language, and thank you, Tara, for having me on your program today.
Yes, John, thanks for joining us. And we keep throwing out that word adjudication. Go ahead and define it for us, for our listening audience, all the unlawyers out there.
Well, what it comes down to is you don't really have any rights to water until your right has been adjudicated by a court. So it's all involved in a legal process, and there's no way around that. On paper, tribes have substantial rights to water under the U.S. Supreme Court decision in U.S. against Winters in 1908, a right to sufficient water for present and future uses with the priority date as early as the time the reservation was established, but that has to be established in court in a specific quantity of water, and that's what the adjudication process is all about.
All right. And, John, you know, just taking a look at the Nez Perce water settlement, we start learning lessons of how tribes connect to the law, also the relationship with states. And, John, is there anything you'd like to add, just to provide more understanding of how rights to water connect to our different tribes? Is there any key information to really understand to start taking a look at this?
Well, the nature of the right I just described, it's basically a tribal reserve right that has to be quantified through this adjudication process. And as Rebecca pointed out, the laws in this country have worked to the extent where basically our tribal water rights can be determined in state court. And as a general matter, tribal rights are usually adjudicated in federal courts, but this quirk in the law that's occurred has allowed these issues to go forward in state court, and they're not always the most favorable forums for tribes, so it's a particularly difficult process.
And how does Congress factor into this?
Well, Congress basically is the one that passed this law that got interpreted to put us into state court. Congress isn't always our best friend then, and it's something we try to reverse when we are able to negotiate settlements for tribal water rights that need approval by Congress. And Congress, in the end, has to approve these settlements that are negotiated out of court without a congressionally approved settlement, then a tribe has to go completely through the adjudication process in the courts that can take decades.
And John, I'd like to focus in a little bit more on the western states. Anything you want to add about historic claims to water rights that tribes have?
Well, this is an issue that we took up early when we started the Native American Rights Fund to provide legal representation to so many tribes that didn't have lawyers back in 1970. And our Native Board of Directors, composed of Native leaders from around the country, identified the protection of tribal water rights as one of the most important issues because, of course, without water, as Rebecca was talking about, you know, really, you really have no future, and it's just so important to our people. So that was really a priority issue, and we were able to involve the federal government as our trustee because our water rights are held in trust for us by the federal government. We implored them to begin filing cases to establish these water rights because, again, paper rights no good. You have to get an adjudicated right. So a lot of tribal water rights litigation was started in the 1970s, and the states who, of course, established water rights under state law saw that if we were successful, that generally their state water rights would be inferior to the more senior tribal water rights that would be established through this litigation process. So they started contesting these cases fiercely, and we were all locked in courts all over the West on these issues and, you know, decades of litigation in front of us. So we all sat down and talked about alternatives to this long litigation process, and, of course, out-of-court settlement was the only alternative. So we all agreed we should start focusing on trying to settle these cases out of court. So that's really been the focus here for the last 40 years or so, 30 or 40 years, and as a result of that, there have been 27 congressionally approved water rights settlements, and we're pleased at the Native American Rights Fund to have been involved in 9 of those cases that have been resolved through these 27 settlements.
All right, and we're going to continue the conversation. John, I also want to hear more about what tribal leaders are doing to educate themselves about the process and also legal issues with water rights. And we want to hear from you today, too. You know, what do you think about what you're hearing so far? You know, taking a closer look at how the law works when it comes to Native America and water rights. Give us a call. Share your thoughts. Maybe you have a question you want to ask John or Rebecca. You can by picking up the phone and calling us at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And what do you think about the statement we heard in the first half? The future of water settlements is scary. Do you agree? We want to hear from you, 1-800-99-NATIVE, or maybe you disagree. We want to hear from you, too. 1-800-996-2848 is the number to join the conversation. We'll continue with both John and Rebecca after the break. And if you'd like to send us a tweet, you can. We're at 1-800-99-NATIVE. You can also find us on Facebook and post your comments there, or maybe pose a question. We'll be right back after this break, but the phone lines are ready for you to give us a ring. And we're going to pause for a moment to hear a little bit more about what is coming up tomorrow on our Electronic Talking Circle. We'll be right back. The Supreme Court's recent Hobby Lobby ruling has sparked a national conversation about access to contraception. Do you have concerns about certain types of birth control? Where do Native Americans fit into this debate? Is access to birth control equal for everyone? Join us as we talk about the contraception controversy on the next Native America Calling.
I'm Nathan. My job gave me a lot. It gave me an income to support my family. It gave me purpose and pride. But the secondhand smoke there triggered my severe asthma attacks, infections, and lung damage. And I never smoked. It was so bad that my doctor told me I shouldn't work there anymore. I had to quit my job. But the damage was done. Now I'm so sick, I can't do much of anything I used to love to do. I don't referee youth basketball anymore. I don't run or lift weights. It's too much for my body to take. Instead, I'm taking breathing treatments or oxygen. I guess you could say my job gave me a lot. So let me give you a tip. Don't let people tell you that working around secondhand smoke is safe.
Smoking affects more than just your health. If you or someone you know wants free help to quit smoking, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
Sacred Wind Communications education nonprofit, Sacred Wind Community Connect, is a proud sponsor of this program. Sacred Wind provides high school and college scholarships and internet training to areas of the Navajo Nation and Pueblo of Laguna in New Mexico, where the parent company provides voice and broadband services. Sacred Wind believes that broadband technologies can reinforce Native cultures and offer other opportunities for self-determination. For more information, log on to sacredwindcommunications.com. The Wheelwright Museum of the American Indian in Santa Fe, New Mexico, is proud to sponsor this program. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., the Wheelwright is New Mexico's oldest nonprofit independent museum. Tickets are not required.
Welcome back to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and we're glad you joined us today as we talk about water settlements across Native America. And I'd like to remind you that your voice is important to our conversation. You can join us today to share your thoughts on access to water and tribal water settlements. Has your tribe entered into a water settlement in recent years? And did you agree or disagree with that decision? The number to call is 1-800-996-2848. And also, what challenges do you see in the future for water management in your community? Dial 1-800-99-NATIVE and tell us. Here's something that came in. Gordon got in touch with us through Native America Calling's Facebook, and he says there's enough water in his community, but nearby people also need and want water for their community's future too. He also says, I imagine the fight will be on in the future as long as the population grows. What do you think? Are you also concerned? Call us right now, 1-800-996-2848. I want to go ahead and bring back our guests. On the line with us is Rebecca Miles. She's the executive director of the Nez Perce Tribe. And also with us is John Echohawk, the executive director of the Native American Rights Fund. And I want to welcome both of you back. And John, wanted to give you a moment to share your thoughts on when it comes to our tribal leaders. You know, what are they doing to educate themselves about the process? So, or, you know, what does a tribal leader need to learn in order to be up to speed so that they are making good decisions?
Well, I think tribal leaders can learn from each other on these tribal water rights issues. The Native American Rights Fund works with the Western States Water Council in a symposium on the settlement of tribal water rights claims every 2 years, and we invite all of the tribal leaders, state leaders, federal leaders, and private parties involved in these negotiations to come to this symposium and get the latest information on how the settlement negotiations are going on, and how tribes and states and private parties and the federal government who recently negotiated settlements were able to do that and really kind of learn from each other and be able to make better judgments about entering into settlement negotiations and conducting those negotiations and finalizing a settlement and getting it through Congress.
All right. Thanks for that, John. Again, 1-800-99-NATIVE is the number to join the conversation. And, you know, when it comes to securing our rights, you know, do you think tribes are able to secure those rights? Call us. Tell us what you think. Why or why not? 1-800-99-NATIVE. I'd like to now welcome Andres Chiama. Andres is the coordinator of the Water Rights Program for the Zuni Tribe. He's also acting director for restoration in Arizona with the Colorado River Wetlands Program. And Andres is from the Zuni Tribe. Welcome to Native America Calling, Andres.
KC, good morning. Glad to be on the show.
And we're glad to have you here, too. And Andres, you know, why are water rights important for the Zuni Tribe?
Well, one of the things that we settled on the Little Colorado River has to do with sacred lands that the tribe wanted to do some restoration work. And so we entered into a adjudication, and luckily for us, we carved out a separate settlement compared to the comprehensive Colorado River, Little Colorado River adjudication that's still ongoing. What it did was that we wanted water to do some restoration work in Arizona. This land is very sacred to the tribe. Its western name is the Zuni Heavens, and Zuni we call it Kosuwala, which has a spiritual and religious connection with the Zuni people. So it was very important to get some water down there and try to do some restoration work.
All right. We're going to take a call. We're going to continue to hear more about water issues in Zuni. But again, you can join 1-800-996-2848. We're going to Marty. He's in Spokane, Washington, tuned in on KSFC. Marty, what would you like to ask?
I was wanted to ask John if he knew anything about the modernizing of the Columbia River Treaty with the Sierra Club.
All right, Marty, hold tight. John, go ahead.
No, I don't really know anything about that, but Rebecca may know something about it.
All right, Rebecca?
Yes, thank you. You know, as stated earlier, I'm the executive director of the tribe. I'm personally no longer involved in the policy discussions, but I am at a distance aware of what's going on with the Columbia River Treaty. The Nez Perce, if you're aware of the treaty, the tribes were not a party to the current Columbia River Treaty, which the caller had identified as the Columbia River. We were major users of that river, the senior most user. And so the tribes are working very hard, the Columbia River and the Tribal Fish Commission, to be a party to this next round of this next agreement. I am not aware of the what he's mentioning, the modernizing of the treaty with the Sierra Club. I haven't followed what's going on with that. I only know that, you know, the tribes are working very hard to make sure that we are a part of this agreement this next go around.
All right. And, you know, if you are connected to the issue, feel free to give us a call. Also, you can post information on Native America Calling's Facebook page or shoot us an email. We want to know more about water and how Native people are connecting to it. We do many shows a year, and water is something we also focus in on. Again, 1-800-99-NATIVE, and our email address is comments@nativeamericacalling.com. And are there treaty rights that are dealing with water in your community right now? And do you feel you have a voice in the process? Call us, 1-800-99-NATIVE. And Andres, you know, what kind of settlements have the Zuni tribe approved in the past that are really impacting access to water today?
For the tribe, it's trying to access some of the water that traditionally flowed down the Little Colorado River. Right now, there's two dams that were constructed, and then one's used by irrigation company, which holds a lot of water. So the only time that water flows through the reservations in Arizona, the reservations land in Arizona, is around summertime when you have intensive rainstorms and you have the monsoons coming in. That's about the only time you have any substantial flows going down towards the reservation, other than when we make a call on our waters. But those amounts are not enough to move any of the sediment to do some of the work that needs to be done.
And Andres, why do you have to take a look at both the past and future when preparing a water claim?
For the zoning heavens area, we had to look in the past because we needed to justify why we wanted the water. We looked at some of the old writings that some of the friars who came up with Coronado wrote up in their journals and things like that. And even in late 1800s, when they were doing a recon of the river with Lorenzo Sitgreaves, I think it was, that wrote that that environment had was a wetland environment. Now it's just dry. There's nothing really there that resembles any wetlands. Fortunately, we did get some money from the state of Arizona to start an initial project to kind of reestablish some of the wetlands in there, but that's driven mostly by groundwater. What we're trying to do is have surface flows come down on the LCR, which is the Little Colorado River, and upgrade the channel, because right now some of the channels in size by maybe 15 feet in depth and about like 20 feet wide. So what we're trying to do is upgrade the channel that hopefully somewhere down in the future it can achieve overbank flows to sustain the wetlands, and then also hopefully bring up the water table. And then there is a sacred spring in there was a sacred spring in that area that was some of the religious people used. Now it's just dry, and then we're trying to hopefully through this restoration work try to bring that spring back if that's possible.
All right. And if there are folks there in Zuni who would like to share their thoughts on this and how it's affecting your community, you can call us 1-800-99-NATIVE. That's also 1-800-996-2848. And I'd like to now welcome Stanley Pollock. Stanley is the Assistant Attorney General in the Water Rights Unit for the Navajo Nation Department of Justice. Welcome to Native America Calling, Stanley.
Thank you, Tara. Good morning to everybody.
Great to have you here, Stanley. Anything you'd like to share about, you know, how this plays into the Navajo Nation and what the community is facing? You know, what are the goals right now for the Navajo Nation when it comes to water settlements?
Well, the Navajo Nation has a special challenge because it's located in three different states. And as John mentioned earlier, the state courts actually have jurisdiction to adjudicate the water rights claims. So that presents a special challenge for Navajo to be in three different states. The reservation itself, though, is typical of other southwestern reservations where we have a semi-arid climate. We don't have an abundance of water resources. And folks out here, for the large part, lack developed water infrastructure. So as many as 40% of the Navajo homes on the reservation lack indoor plumbing, and Navajo people have to haul water great distances just to get water to their homes. So that presents a very special challenge because building water infrastructure to people's homes to convey fresh water is a very expensive proposition. So as part of our water settlement strategy, we've looked at trying to utilize settlements as an opportunity to bring people drinking water.
And Stanley, does the Navajo Nation believe it is possible to go back and fix concerns about access to water through water settlements?
Well, we approved a settlement in 2004 for the San Juan River in New Mexico, and the centerpiece of that settlement was the construction of the Navajo Gallup Drinking Water Supply Project. And that project basically brings fresh, reliable, renewable, and sustainable high-quality surface water into the Navajo communities in New Mexico. So yes, there are ways to transform the landscape and to provide sustainable water. And we think that water settlements are an excellent opportunity to do that.
All right. Again, 1-800-99-NATIVE. It gets you into the conversation. And maybe you've been involved in negotiations for a water settlement. You know, what did you learn through that process that you think people don't understand? And we'd like to hear from you today. Call in and share your insights on, you know, all the legal, political, and emotional challenges that come with being a part of a water settlement negotiation. Call us right now, 1-800-99-NATIVE. There is still time left in the hour. Let's go to a caller. We have Philip in Ewok, Arizona, tuned in on KDLG. And Philip, what would you like to share?
Yeah, good morning. My name is Philip Agagop Sr. I live along the Nishgack River. The Nishgack River is not dammed up yet and for irrigation or for power. And under the tribal law, I think the tribal sovereign villages of an indigenous village along the Nishgack have the water rights of the Nishgack, not the regional corporations. That's my question.
All right, Philip, thanks. And correction, you are in Alaska, not Arizona. John, if you can help us out with this one, you know, when it comes to Alaska Native corporations having water rights, anything you'd like to add? Go ahead, John.
Well, I think this is a new issue in Alaska that's coming to the forefront now. And the question is the application of tribal water rights precedents to the tribes in Alaska. And I would think that those precedents would protect the rights of the tribes in Alaska and that those rights would accrue to the tribes and not the native corporations.
All right. Thank you for your call, Philip. And of course, you can also connect with us through Facebook or send us a tweet at 1-800-99-NATIVE. And Stanley, we've done a lot of talk about water settlements or taking it to the courts and negotiations. When it comes to the Navajo Nation and the experience and history you've learned, are water settlements better than taking the issue to court?
Well, Tara, that's the ultimate question before any tribe when they have to consider a water settlement. And in fact, in any litigation when you're considering a settlement, one has to consider, is settlement better than the alternative of going to litigation? And there's a number of factors that have to be concerned, that you have to be concerned about. One of them is the judicial system is becoming increasingly hostile to the interests of Native American people. And in 1988, the Supreme Court was one vote away from actually repealing the Winters Doctrine or greatly limiting the Winters Doctrine, as John points out. And since that time, the Supreme Court has become even more hostile towards Indian interests. And so avoiding the legal process is something that tribes have to be aware of. The other thing that I mentioned was, and the other consideration is that if you're trying to provide drinking water to your people or wet water development, you can't get that by litigation. Litigation only gives you a paper right to use water. It doesn't give you the means to actually put that water to use. And so what tribes are doing these days is looking at what we call settling, trading paper water rights for wet water, trading some of the water rights that they might secure in litigation in favor of getting the funding necessary to build wet water development. And one final thing that I think is really important to mention is that when you go to settlement, you control the terms of the settlement in the sense that if you don't like the settlement, you can always reject it. The tribe has the ability to say no. But when you go to court, the tribe doesn't have the ability to say no to the court, and the court will make the determination as to what the tribe's water rights are. And as one of the tribal council members at Navajo said, do we want to have a settlement, or do we want to go to court where probably a white guy wearing a black robe who knows very little about Indian law and Indian culture is going to make these determinations for you? And to me, that's the ultimate question. Are you better off with certainty of settlement or the uncertainty of going to court?
And Stanley, you know, that might be hard to explain to our tribal communities. Often you hear it as interpreted in a negative way, that basically you're giving up rights, you're giving up water. Anything you want to add to that? You know, how do you explain this?
Well, I think that's the real challenge, and I was particularly taken by Judy's call at the beginning of this show, where she talked about the settlement as being a great waiver of water rights and the rights of the tribes. The problem is this. We can sit amongst ourselves as advocates for Indian people or as Indian people ourselves and talk about what our rights are or what they ought to be. But ultimately, the determination of those rights when you go to court is not going to be made by Indian people. It's not going to be made by Indian judges. It's going to be made by, as I said before, probably white men wearing a black robe who have little experience with Indian people. And so it's a completely different experience when you go to court. And, you know, you can either settle or you go to court, you litigate. But just sitting back and saying, you know, we own all the water in the river, we're entitled to all the water that flows through the reservations, things like, of that nature, those are easy things to say, but courts aren't necessarily going to agree. And I think that's one of the problems that lay people have when they look at the water settlements, because they think a settlement is a compromise. And if there's a compromise, then perhaps the tribe is giving up too much. And I think the challenge for the advocates for Indian water rights is to find solutions that create, you know, essentially win-win for everybody, that where we're not really giving up significant rights, but we are gaining significant benefits out of the settlement.
All right. Andres, anything you want to add? What do you think about that?
I agree with the negative connotation of settlement. I mean, we deal with that. We're going through adjudication on the Luna River, and right now we're in the process of trying to negotiate a settlement. But the perception is that, Stan was talking about, there is a perception that you're compromising some of your rights in order to get a settlement. But, you know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. You know, the settlement for the tribe, you know, in Arizona, we kind of took that, you know, because we really didn't have that much of a option as far as going through litigation. Once you do the analysis, we didn't have a strong case in the Little Colorado River. So the next course was try to negotiate a settlement, which we did. And obviously we didn't get all of the stuff that we wanted. We were kind of restricted on some issues. But we did get some funds to acquire water rights, and that's what we're using those development funds to kind of fund this program for some of the restoration work that needs to be done, and even severing and transferring some of the water rights that have been acquired onto the what we call the project site.
All right. Thanks for that, Andres. And got a quick moment for a couple of wrap-ups. Rebecca, I want to go ahead and give you a moment for any final thoughts or any advice on lessons learned when it comes to water claims versus water settlements.
Well, you know, this has been a great discussion, and it brings back a lot of, you know, things that came up in our process. And, of course, you know, when we got to our term sheet, all the negotiation was over. And so as a young person coming in this, you know, what really helped me out was looking and reading third party, you know, comments or reviews or articles about the settlement, even legal, you know, professors from law schools, those kinds of things, of what they had to say about our settlement. You know, there was enough uncertainty, and we had more uncertainty in ours. It wasn't just what all the tribes have to face. But we also, people forget, we also had all of our water rights thrown out in state court. And the state court judge stated that our reservation was diminished. So added to that, we were coming on the bush administration where we were fearful that the Bush would be able to nominate two Supreme Court justices. History told us that he did. He actually did. And so that's what we would be up against if we went that route. And we would have got, if we would have been deemed victorious, if we would have went that route and fought all the way to the Supreme Court, we would have mostly got water, the winner's rights water, which would have probably been maybe just less than half of what we got now, which was about 50,000 acre feet of water for consumptive use. We wouldn't have got water for fish. We were able to reserve in stream flows for fish, and we wouldn't have most likely got our streams and fountains claims that are now located on state and private lands back. So there's there's every water settlement is every adjudication is its own unique being and has its own, facts and things to consider. So I just encourage tribes that, everybody has a stake in it. There's the public, the tribal public. There's those that are elected. It's to ensure, you're educated about the whole, all the processes and all everything at stake, because these are very important decisions that that tribes have to make, every year tribes have to make.
Sure, and they're definitely connecting to our futures. I want to thank everybody for joining us today. A good keyword to Google when you're looking at water rights is the winter's decision. Thanks to our guests today, Rebecca Miles, Stanley Pollock, Andres Chiama, and also John Echohawk. Our executive producer is Sarah Gustavus. Monica Breen is our senior producer, and Andy Murphy is our associate producer. Stephen Emmons engineered today's show, and also thanks to National Native News and Native Voice One. And this show was produced with support from New Mexico In-Depth and reporter Laura Paskus. And for more information about New Mexico In-Depth online, you can find them online, nmindepth.com. I'm your host, Tara Gatewood. Join us again tomorrow for a conversation about what we're doing in Native America. Thanks for joining us today. And you can also visit our website, nativeamericacalling.com. We'll be back tomorrow.
I'm Nathan. My job gave me a lot. It gave me an income to support my family. It gave me purpose and pride. But the secondhand smoke there triggered my severe asthma attacks, infections, and lung damage. And I never smoked. It was so bad that my doctor told me I shouldn't work there anymore. I had to quit my job. But the damage was done. Now I'm so sick, I can't do much of anything I used to love to do. I don't referee youth basketball anymore. I don't run or lift weights. It's too much for my body to take. Instead, I'm taking breathing treatments or oxygen. I guess you could say my job gave me a lot. So let me give you a tip. Don't let people tell you that working around secondhand smoke is safe.
Smoking affects more than just your health. If you or someone you know wants free help to quit smoking, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.